Anthony Davis, without questioning, is a major talent. You're not going to stay in front of Anthony Davis. He's too athletic. He pushed the ball on the floor. Let's get it back to what this is all about, is winning. What is his impact on winning?
Rick Bucher. When Russ Westbrook is scoring 50-plus and the triple-double, I feel if Anthony Davis is not only able to put up those kind of numbers, but he should be able to put up winning numbers. If you put up 50 and you lose, I have a hard time giving that as much credence.
This is the B.J. Armstrong and Rick Bucher Show, starring B.J. and Bucher.
Welcome to the latest edition of the BJ and Bucher podcast. I am Rick Bucher. He is BJ Armstrong. We will be joined later, fourth quarter, our first ever guest of the podcast, Brendan Sir, associate head coach of the LSU Tigers, coached Ben Simmons last year, has seen the documentary. It'll be very interesting to get into what he thought of that documentary, which was somewhat disparaging, both of the NCAA and the LSU program, including how Ben was coached. So we will get into that with him. But BJ, welcome to the program. Let's get started.
And by the way, before we start, I love Coach Sir. He's one of the most knowledgeable people in the game of basketball that I've been around, and I've had the pleasure for knowing him for many, many years. And can't wait to get him on and hear what he has to say.
All right. So let's start with the topics. We're in the first quarter, and we need to go around the league as we do in the first quarter. The season is in full swing, and we still have three teams who are winless at this point. The Dallas Mavericks, the Philadelphia 76ers, both 0-5. New Orleans Pelicans, also 0-6. And BJ, I'm just wondering, you know, we often talk about it takes, 20-25 games to know where your team really is at and what you need to do. But when you have a start like this with these three programs, as a former front office executive, you've seen this from every angle, as a player, as a front office guy. At what point do you go, we need to do something. We need to start rethinking what we have on this roster. When does that happen? And are any of these three teams at that point?
Well, when I look at the rosters of these teams, and to answer your question, just to be very frank, you know, you have two choices in this league. You put together your roster with two thoughts in mind. The business, clearly you want to put out a team that's entertaining, that the fans can identify with in your particular city, and to play a style that's visually, that's fun to watch, a la the Golden State Warriors. When I look at these three teams, Dallas and Philly, I don't think right now they are a team that was put together saying we're going to win a championship at this particular moment. I don't think either one of those two teams really were trying to get to the playoffs. I think they're in a, especially Dallas, they're in a state of transition. They have an aging superstar in Dirk Nowitzki, and now they're putting together a team with trying to rebuild or retool, as they call it today, and to implement their young players and develop their young players. Philly, clearly, they're just trying to see what they have. You know, they're getting Joel Embiid back. They've got some other young kids, come Okafor, Nerlens Noel, coming through injuries through the draft. So they're a team right now that's really trying to figure out who they are, what they are, and what's a realistic goal. On the other hand, you have a very interesting scenario because you have, you know, a top, you know, five player there with Anthony. Anthony Davis. And now you have a player who there that's ready to win. Clearly he's averaging over 30 points a game. And at the same time, they're not ready to win. So I think with the New Orleans team, I think they're the only team where they have the pressure, if you will, to get into the playoffs. So I don't anticipate any of these teams making any bold moves before this. Maybe New Orleans will try to do something if they continue down this path. I think they're the only team with the expectation right now to win, because there's only two choices you have: win, or you try to really shore up the business. When I say the business, you're just saying you're putting together a product out there that's very entertaining. And I think New Orleans is the only team right now that has that pressure to win at this point.
All right. Topic two: LeBron James has now passed Hakeem Olajuwon for 10th on the NBA's all-time scoring list with 26,946 points. And I know this is in some ways a subject near and dear to your heart, because Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, in our conversations, my conversations with you, you feel he's never really gotten the recognition that he deserves as being discussed as one of the all-time great players, maybe the great all-time, the greatest to ever play it, because of all the points that he scored. Now, you look at where LeBron is, he's got 26,946. Kareem remains at the very top with 38,387. We're talking about almost, 12,000 more points than what LeBron James has at this point in his career.
Wow.
I ask you, when you look at that list, first of all, do you think that LeBron has a shot at age 32 at being able to eclipse Kareem's record, all-time record for points?
Well, he has a shot. I mean, just going years. I mean, the kid came in the league when he was 18. So I think he definitely has a shot.
But see, I disagree. I don't think he has no shot.
How come? Why doesn't he have no shot?
Because he's 32. First of all, he's not starting. The clock doesn't start. I mean, we look at calendar age. We go, okay, well, Kareem played until 38. Kareem didn't, lose some of his athleticism, and he could still be a scorer. But the clock for him didn't start in the NBA at 18. He went through college. And so I don't see any way in which, in fact, as amazing as LeBron has been physically, that he's going to play to age 38. I'm not convinced that he's going to pass Kobe Bryant at 33,000 some points. Because right now, you look at what he's done the last couple of years. If he averages 2,000 points a season, he's going to need, at least another four seasons. He's going to have to play 40. He's got to play to 36 just to get past Kobe. I just don't see a way in which it's realistic that he's going to pass Kareem.
Well, again, if LeBron is healthy and he seems to be playing at a very, very high level at this age of 32. What is he, 32 now? I see no reason why this kid, if he remains healthy, can't play at a very high level until he's 38, 39, possibly 40 years old. I mean, at some point, what year is this for him now? 12, 13 or somewhere around there?
This is year 14. Season 14.
Year 14.
Season this 14. Think about that.
Exactly. And he hasn't had really a drop off yet. He's aged very well in this league.
He has.
I think he can maintain this for another 4 to 5
Ooh.
Years and change his game. The one thing about LeBron is he has the ability to be a post player and be very effective just playing from the post without using his athletic ability.
But you know what?
A la Michael Jordan. Michael Jordan, at the second half of his career, he was just a post player.
Right.
LeBron James could be today's power forward, the new age
I agree.
He could be that change his game and be perfectly fine as a power forward.
You know what else I'm going to say?
And be an all-star at the power forward.
Could have been for the last couple of years. Moving on. Ray Allen, a.k.a. Jesus Shuttlesworth. This might be my favorite topic of the first quarter.
You just smile every time you say that.
Oh,
you love that. You love Jesus Shuttlesworth.
I love
you
Jesus love Shuttlesworth. And I really respect Ray Allen. And I'll tell you why. Because he's officially retired now. Eligible because he hasn't played for a couple of years, but he only announced just now that he's retiring. And he's the all-time leader in threes in the league. So I'm just wondering, also two-time NBA champion, 10-time NBA All-Star, what do you have a most memorable Ray Allen moment? Because mine is I took a tour with him of Alcatraz when he was with the Milwaukee Bucks. The whole team went out there. I was working on a magazine piece. He had a lot of similarities to Reggie Miller in that he was so exact about, he was almost superstitious in terms of his routine. The Celtics used to mess with him all the time. He'd come on the plane and Paul Pierce would be sitting in his chair and it would drive Ray Allen nuts. You're in my chair. Get out of my chair. Like, you just would drive him nuts. But what I discovered on the Alcatraz tour, you're not allowed to bring outside food onto, they're very strict rules. They've got to have a lot of issues with the being green and the taking care of the island and everything. And I look over as the tour guide is saying, here are the rules and no outside food and no eating during the tour. And I look over and there's Ray Allen, son of a military man, disciplinarian, exact about his, like, his diet and his training and his program. And he looks over at me and he pops half a chocolate candy bar in his mouth and winks. And I'm like, there's another side to Ray Allen that nobody has seen. And I just got a glimpse of it. That's my favorite.
There's one word that comes to mind when I think of Ray Allen. Class. He's just a class human being, class person. And he had an amazing, amazing career. My favorite story is about Ray Allen is when you came in, when I came into this league, you know, there's a couple, you know, directions you can go. We all have to at some point commit to being a professional, right? Either, you know, some of us, you know, it takes us a little time to become professional. Some of us never get to become professionals. And then some of us walk in the door as a professional from day one. That was Ray Allen. Ray Allen was a professional from the very first moment he walked into the NBA. He was very consistent. He exemplified really what a prototypical two guard was in this league. He took on his matchup every night. And I always respected him from the very first moment that I saw him as a pro. And he carried that out throughout his career. You know, some players, they have drop-offs in their career. Ray Allen was still shooting with the same consistency when he left the league when he first came in. So I always respected him about that. And I always respected how he perfected his craft. So I have nothing but the utmost respect for him, and I wish him very well. And whatever he's going to do now that he's officially given us his retirement notice.
Well said. Let's go to the second quarter.
I'm at the 76ers game to sing the national anthem, and the organization is telling me that I can't because I'm wearing a We Matter jersey.
October 26th, the 76ers snubbed national anthem singer Seven Streeter by not allowing her to sing. They pulled her at the last second because she was wearing a We Matter shirt that night. It said We Matter on her T-shirt. And there was a big public outcry as a result of that. And the 76ers, I don't know if it was a day or two later, said they apologized and said, we want to bring her back. Well, now they've met with Seven, and she is going to come back and sing the anthem December 16th at the Wells Fargo Center. And she's going to wear her We Matter T-shirt. She and the 76ers have agreed to work with the Boys and Girls Club in order to not just make a statement as far as bringing her back to sing the anthem, but that there is going to be a community outreach that is going to be fostered by all this. Now, I don't know how much this means to you, but, you know, we've had the questions about Colin Kaepernick's controversy and protest when it comes to kneeling during the national anthem. And the presidential election has brought a lot of conversation about race and race relations. What do you think about, and we asked this on the podcast, I asked you about as an executive, you know, how does a decision like that get made? I have to tell you, BJ, I'm rather astounded in a good way that the 76ers have done the mea culpa that they have, that they've apologized the way that they have, and that they've completely flipped and said, Seven, we want to bring you back. You can wear what you want. We will participate with you in whatever you want. And have made a big show about saying, we got it wrong the first time around, and we want to make it right. Now, does that encourage you, or do you think, I can't believe that we would have the decision that was made in the first place?
Well, the first thing I want to say, I love the fact that they have the ability to reflect. You know, one of the things in my business is I always say reason and logic doesn't enter into the game until much later in the game. Clearly, in this situation, after reflecting upon what happened, how this was handled from the first, how it was first handled till now, someone did some reflection. Someone rethought the situation and said, you know what? And it was like a self-correcting issue. So I love it when people are self-correcting, especially in a situation where clearly there was a miscommunication somewhere. So I don't have a problem with anyone that says, you know what, my bad, my fault, and take responsibility and ownership of what happened. So, you know what, my hat's off to Philadelphia for self-correcting themselves and allowing people to express themselves and allowing people to get out, and that's what this country was built off. I mean, freedom of expression, being able to you know, say and do things in a very respectful manner and have open dialogue about it. So I don't have a problem with it. So I'm very, very pleased on what has transpired here between Philadelphia and allowed this young woman here to come out and sing, to sing and express herself and show her views.
What are you doing? It's just a halftime.
Yes, this is my favorite part of the game.
In honor of the 76ers snub, I have no idea what's coming, but I've beefed about the fact that BJ and our producer, our great producer, Shane Freeman, have hijacked the halftime entertainment in spite of okie-doking me.
You're so sensitive about the music.
Yes, I am sensitive. I play piano. I've been playing piano since I was 6 years old. I consider myself somewhat of a musical aficionado. And you guys just gave me the, that's a nice choice. That's a nice choice, Buke. And then never heard of again. So supposedly you're making it up for me. I with trepidation, I say, stay tuned to the halftime show. It's supposed to be a payback for me. I don't know what kind of payback, but enjoy the music.
Well, Rick, let me be the first as the producer to say this. I'm not going back on the snub. You know, I'm not the 76ers. You know, I don't typically say I'm sorry when I don't mean it, so I ain't going to say I'm sorry. But what I will do is I'm going to play the record, the Anthony Hamilton record, because, you know.
Nice.
That's I probably should have did it. You know, that was my
thank
bad.
You, thank you.
I'll take
thank
that
you,
one. Thank you. I'll take
thank
that one.
You guys are crazy.
Thank you.
You guys are crazy.
Well, I'm mad at the way she loved me, and I'm mad at the way she cared. I'm mad at the way she touched me, at the way that she combed my hair. I'd be lying if I said I didn't mean a thing. I'd be lying if I said I didn't care. I'd be lying if I said I didn't love her. I'm still here. I'm still here. I'm mad at the way she loved me, and I'm mad at the time we spent. I'm mad about our conversation. I'm mad about everything. I'd be lying if I said I didn't mean a thing. I'd be lying if I said I didn't care. I'd be lying if I said I didn't mean a thing. I'm still here. I'm still.
All right, now, what is quickly becoming the most popular quarter of the podcast? We're in the third quarter, and this is the trivia knowledge section. And Shane Freeman, our producer, has quite a doozy for us, because now we are not going NBA knowledge. We are going WNBA knowledge.
What?
Yes, yes. And I,
what?
And I get to ask the first question. And by the way, supposedly we're going to heighten the demand for whoever loses has to put out the tweet. I don't know more about the game than my co-host.
Yeah, I didn't get my tweet last week.
Yeah, you know what? I didn't get my tweet the week before. So we're even, and we'll see how Shane adjudicates this going forward. But here's the first question. Who was the first player drafted in the inaugural WNBA draft? And which team drafted her? Are you looking it up? You can't look it up. No cheating.
I don't get a multiple. I should just like.
I'm surprised.
Multiple choice?
Normally there are multiple choices, but apparently this one's so obvious. That
I'm telling you, you and Shane are. You guys are in cahoots for sure.
It's a conspiracy, man.
All right, I'm just gonna say, Rebecca Logo, the New York Liberty.
No! You know what? That's not a bad guess, but it's wrong. Cheryl Swoops, Houston Comets. All right, what do you have for me?
Name the four WNBA teams who represented the Eastern Conference when the league launched in 1997. I think Shane right now has way too much time on his hands.
Oh, no. Oh no. Whoo. Okay.
You give. Just give up. Just give up.
I'm gonna
you
say.
Even,
I'm
you
gonna
can't
say,
even name
well,
four teams. I'm you can't say, even name four teams in the WNBA.
I could. Oh, I can do that. But I know all the West Coast teams. That's what I mean. Houston Comets was one of the originals. I just stole that. The New York Liberty. I don't think the Indiana Fever were around then. There was a Connecticut team. I can't give you four. I'm just going to take the L.
Taking the L.
Who are they?
Actually, you got two other four. The Houston Comets, the New York Liberty, the Cleveland Rockers.
It said Eastern Conference. The Houston Comets were in the Eastern Conference?
Yes, they were. Yes, they were.
And the Charlotte Steam.
Oh,
this is correct.
Wow. Okay. All right. This is your second question. And this is multiple choice, so you have a shot.
Oh, great.
This player holds the WNBA record for most career points. Is it Cheryl Swoops, Cynthia Cooper, Tina Thompson, or Shamika Holtzclaw?
Say that again, because I was looking for one. Say those again.
Cheryl Swoops, who was the answer to your first question. Cynthia Cooper, her teammate on the Houston Comets, if I'm not mistaken. Tina Thompson or Shamika Holtzclaw?
I'm going to say Tina.
Ding, 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 ding. You are correct. Tina Thompson.
She played a long time. I remember her being around a long time. Okay.
7,488 points. Oh, man. Now the pressure.
Okay. This puts
pressure
a lot of pressure on you. Ooh, I'm loving this. Okay. Right. Here we go.
Which player became the first player to score in a WNBA game? A, Rebecca Lobo. B.
Are you saying logo or Lobo?
Lobo.
Okay.
Lobo. Right. Which I will say logo if you want me to.
No.
Rebecca Lobo.
Yes.
Penny Toller.
Yep.
Cheryl Swoops. Or Tisha Pinchinero? Pinchinero.
Do I get credit for correcting his pronunciation of
star
from Portugal?
You do, because that's one of my things. I don't like to miss.
All right. Give me those four again.
Rebecca Lobo.
Yes.
Penny Toller.
Yeah.
Cheryl Swoops. Or Tisha.
Pinchinero.
Pinchinero. Just take this out.
Shamika was the first pick of the 1999 draft. Oh, wait a minute. Did you include Shamika?
No, I didn't. Oh. I don't know where that came from. I don't know where that came from.
Oh, you said Cheryl Swoops.
Yes.
So she was the first. She was, you know what? I'm going to go off the board. I'm going to say it was Penny Toller. I got it right?
Yeah, you did.
Oh,
yeah, you did.
Oh, that's so strong.
How do you know?
I don't know. I'm guessing.
As a member of the Los Angeles Sparks, she sank the first ever 2 points in a WNBA game versus the New York Liberty.
It is amazing the things that, like the lint. You have that lint catcher in the dryer. I have one in my head. And the weird, like, little things that it catches. I can't remember what I'm supposed to do for my wife the next day, but I can remember, like, Penny Toller. Why do I remember that name? 2-2,
okay,
so we have a tiebreaker. Shane, we need a tiebreaker.
I have a tiebreaker for you. The first person to give me the correct answer, you only get one shot at it, though.
Okay.
So this player recorded the first goal 10 in WNBA history.
Yes. Yes.
Was it A, Lisa Leslie, B, Rebecca Lobo, or as BJ would say, logo.
That's cool.
I knew you said that. You said that the first time. You did. I wasn't here to think.
C, Elena Baranova, or D, Sylvia Fold.
What was the third one?
Elena Baranova.
I'm saying the first, the what's her name?
I'm going Lisa Leslie.
With those Lisa Leslie, that's what I'm saying.
It's Sylvia Foles on June 3rd, 2008.
All right, so do you have another one?
I do have another
one for
you.
I'm feeling the pressure build, man.
True or false? Should be simple. Shaq holds the NBA record for the most seasons leading the league in field goal percentage.
Yes.
You said true?
That's false.
Wait a minute. That's the tiebreaker?
That's false.
I'm going to say it's false, too.
Both of y'all wrong.
It's true. Oh, that's why you were waiting. You know what?
Did you see how I played that? Oh, did you see me do that? He didn't know, so I just blurted it out. He just swayed him.
He didn't know.
Wait a minute. That's some weird psychology. Awesome. You poured the wrong answer so that I would pour the wrong answer too?
He said the first person who answered.
Yeah. He said,
and
yes.
then you answered true. And I was like, oh, God. So I want you to think about it. Yeah, you said yes. So I was like, oh, God, that's right. And then I just like threw that out there. You were like, wait a minute. And you second guessed yourself. I loved it.
That's it. We're both losers this week. Got no more tiebreakers. All right. Going to the fourth quarter. And we're about to be joined by the great Brendan Serr, associate head coach of the LSU Tigers. Now I'd like to welcome in the first guest of the BJ and Bucher podcast. I mean, the first ever. Brendan Serr, an assistant head coach in the league, is now associate head coach with the LSU Tigers, and we welcome him to the show. Coach Serr, glad to have you.
Rick, I'm honored. First is great. To be with BJ and you, it's outstanding. As I told Magic and Larry Bird one day, I said, you know, the three of us came in the NBA in 1979-80. The three of us saved the league. And they looked at me and they said, three of us. So we're going to have a great time, and I appreciate you having me on.
You got to talk to me about, you know, you were there, those great Detroit Piston teams, those bad boy teams who were really defending in the 80s and 90s. And we had a lot of success there. How would you defend today's game with today's stars and the rules and how they play today?
Yeah, well, the game has, and like all everything in life, the game has changed. I'm not one of those people that have their head in the sand and say, oh, it was way better then, it's better now, you know, all that stuff, athletes better and all. As it moves forward, you have to adjust. And so right now, as opposed to when I came in the league, when you came in the league, there was a lot more set offenses, a lot less transition, very physical defense, hand-checking was allowed. Coaching was very, very good. Our staffs were very, very small. I remember in 89, in 90 when the Bad Boys were going, there was myself, Brendan Malone, and Chuck. That was it. That was our whole staff. We didn't have any other people. I mean, I picked up the towels. I mean, at the time, we didn't have any staff. Now there's more guys on suits on the bench than are almost our players on the bench. So, and it's happened in college too, so it's really evolved. But I think they're trying to play faster now so they don't have to go against the tremendous technology as aid is scouting. So they really trying to not defend set plays. And so I think that, as always, the team that makes that adjustment quicker has a better style of play, has better players and unselfish players that understand the game. I think they're the ones that are really excelling now. But how would I do it now? How would I do it? I would play the game how my team, based on the talent of my team. If I had the exact team that we had in Detroit, Bill Laimbeer, Rick Mahorn, those guys, they're not running up and down. Even though we averaged 104, 106, 8 points a game when we won, we were very conscious of getting good shots every time down. And then defending like crazy on the way back. So we also were a team that, like all the good teams back then, we didn't give up layups. You didn't get layups against us. And those are hard fouls. And now, if you commit a hard foul, it's a flagrant one and all that stuff. But I think, you have to adjust. But I think the coaching from the head coaches was really outstanding back then. And so now there's been, we've gone through cycles of guys, that have some of the greatest coaches of all time have, none of them are almost left, And so now we're onto a new breed of guys, And so they're finding their way.
One of those new breeds is Ben Simmons, who was at LSU. And there's a documentary that's come out about his experience. But one of the things he was critical of that's gotten a lot of buzz, and sometimes these things are taken out of context, are his comments about his college experience and about the NCAA. When you saw that, when you heard that, what was your reaction?
I thought it was BS, frankly, and not Ben Simmons or Brendan Serr. I mean, I thought it was totally BS. I think that was not a – I think that did not portray who he is, that film. I think they went in with a clear understanding of what was they wanted to sell, those folks, and they did not sell what I think – we were led to believe that they were going. I'll give you an example, Rick. I sat down for 3 hours with them and did an interview, and basically said in my interview that he, and BJ knows this, that he is the best player that I've ever seen to be ready to come into the league, including Magic and Bird.
Yep.
And LeBron, being ready to come. What he does once he gets in, I can't help that. But this kid was so far advanced. And, okay, so that was my feeling. Now, you don't think that's newsworthy, that you would put that freaking clip on there for 10 seconds? Johnny Jones, the head coach, is a terrific coach and a wonderful man. He did over 3 hours of video with them. Not one line of him. The kid had an incredible experience here. You know, I said all along, this kid didn't need college per se from a standpoint of basketball, but he needed college to socialization, to understand how to get along with other people. He had a great time here. Trust me, he had a phenomenal time. He lived a great life as a college student. This is one of the great campuses and schools in America to go to have a great time, to get an education. He did it, okay? That it was portrayed by his sister and him late night FaceTime that, you know, he didn't like it. It's a bunch of bull. Okay. Cause I saw him every day. I think they were trying to sell a concept of one and done is bad and it's not good for you. We said that, you know, here, this kid has stats that no freshman has ever had, Rick, ever in college basketball. We asked him to put those up there. What do you achieve? Because they said his year was a disappointment. But yet no one ever in the SEC has ever done what he had done, ever in the SEC. That's a pretty good league.
One of the other things that you guys, and Brendan, both BJ and I are well aware of your background and history as a coach, but there was a lot of criticism of the coaching staff.
Exactly. And, you know, I don't care about myself. I don't need some freaking Showtime video to validate who I am. My two rings and my dream team thing and coaching 13 players in the NBA validate that I didn't screw them all the way up, you know. But, you know, the thing about this thing was that he was really being coached well. He was not the number one player coming into last season in college basketball. Scott LeBissiere from Kentucky was rated number one. Then it was 2, 3, or 4 on the different lists, scouting lists. And so for our guy to rise to number one with not even – Brandon Ingram's terrific, but it wasn't even a close debate of who to pick if you were a team. And Scal goes 28th, and it was a gift that he went 28th. I'm not saying at all John Calipari didn't do a good job with him, but don't downplay that Johnny Jones screwed this kid up. He allowed this kid to develop at the sake of our team maybe doing as well by letting this kid play point guard, just showing all of his talents. But more importantly, we had our second leading scorer, Keith Hornsby, who was the last cut of Dallas, missed 14 games. And our starting center, Craig Victor, transferred from Arizona, missed the first 9 games. So, we won 19 games. We probably would have won 25 or 26 if we had all of our pieces. But, you know, to downplay that it was almost based on incompetency in a terrible situation was bull, in my opinion.
I can't have you on and not ask you about the Jordan rule.
Because, you know, I'm really, you know, I played against it. I saw it firsthand. But to our listeners, what was the Jordan rule?
It was really simple, and I take only a minimal credit for it. It was basically designed by Isaiah Thomas at basically 3 in the morning after they beat us in game 2, after you beat us in game 2, after having a, 19-point lead in the first half. Michael goes for like 47. And so Isaiah, after he has dinner by himself, goes out on Lake Michigan on a walkway and walks there for hours and hours and calls me at 3 in the morning and says, I need to talk to you. And he has these ideas. And Isaiah is always a great idea guy. And so we meet down in the lobby of the Westin Hotel, and he tells me his ideas. I think they're freaking brilliant, you know. So the next morning I see Chuck, and I say, listen, I talked to Isaiah early this morning. He's just early this morning. I said, well, 3 a.m. And I said, Chuck just rolled his eyes at me and said, really, you think that's going to work? And so we had our team meeting and our you know, visit with our team to watch the film and, you know, said what the Jordan rules would be. The players had came up with some ideas. And Chuck just looked at them and as only he could do, Rick. He just said, ain't going to work. You can't stop this guy, man. No way. We've got the two best defenders in the NBA. We got Joe Dumars and Dennis Rodman, and they can't stop him. And you tell me you want to put some little gimmick up against him, guy's too good. You can't do it. And so basically tells them it's not going to work. Well, Chuck, in his brilliance, basically was saying, and Lambeer now gets involved, and he says, we're doing it, Chuck. You know, that's the kind of team that we had, one of internal leadership. And Joe and Rodman are pissed, you know, because they're like saying, you don't think we're good enough to stop them. But they don't buy in. But the other guys on the team say, yeah. So basically, here it is. When Michael got the ball, if he got the ball at the top of the key, and Doug Collins was the coach, they weren't running triangle. If he got the ball at the top and Doug was doing a lot of isolation, we would force him to his left. Not that Michael couldn't go left. It was just that everyone at least would know which way we were trying to send them. Right. And so the nearest player would then run and double team him. And we knew that Michael was unselfish, that he would pass the ball. And we were just banking that the other guys wouldn't make the shots. And then if he had the ball on the wing, we would force him to the middle, and the nearest player would go and double team him, again, hoping he would pass. If he played pick-and-roll basketball, we would trap him immediately as he came off the pick. And he was back then, he was even posting up a lot. And as soon as he caught the ball in the low post, we would trap him from the top. Okay, so four different areas and stuff. And, you know, and frankly, it worked because Michael passed the ball and certain other players other than BJ didn't make shots. And
look, yes, sir. The Michael Jordan rules, okay, all right, there's a book written, whatever. I want to know what the BJ rules were. What was the BJ scouting report from the Detroit Pistons? How do you stop BJ Armstrong? That's the question I have.
Well, BJ was a very disciplined player who, you know, knew what he could do and what he couldn't do. But he was playing with some of the greatest players of all time. So we wanted BJ to shoot as much as possible because that meant Mike wouldn't shoot. So even if he made one or two, that was fine. But you know, but BJ was a glue guy on that. And plus, you know, I've known him since he was in high school, so I love the man.
Here's the thing, though. I think, you know, people look at the Pistons and the Bulls, and you bring up a great point. They look at the connection between those two, and that was supposed to be this fierce rivalry. They hate each other's guts and everything. But the two teams, in a lot of ways, in their basketball history, were so intertwined. Yeah, you might have had fierce competition for what you wanted, but you guys also, at the end of the day, you knew each other on another level, right?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, back then, you know, you played six times a year. You played seven times in the playoffs. So you'd average playing them 12 to 13 times a year for years and years. So it took the Bulls several years to get through the Pistons, just like it took the Pistons several years to get through the Celtics, et cetera. Yeah. And so, you know, this was there was a time before I got with the team where basically I believe Michael, you know, probably lost 15 of like 16 games to the Pistons. That's how dominant the
yep.
run was,
yep.
you know, prior to that. You know, they just, and Michael might be scoring 47, 50 points. Last thing on this, Rick. When I coached Michael's two kids, Marcus and Jeffrey, at University of Central Florida a few years ago. And so I came out with this book, Chuck Daly, Coaching You. And when Mike came to practice, first day of practice, I hand him a copy, autographed copy and stuff. And the whole practice, rather than watching his kids practice, he's reading the damn book. And in the book, I have the Jordan rules because it was Chuck's philosophy of basketball that he only would let me write after he passed away. And so anyway, the practice finishes. He grabs me and says, hey, this Jordan rules is a bunch of BS. I said, what do you mean? He said, Jordan rules where you had Mahorn and Lambeer and Rodman knocked me on my ass through none of these other things. So, that was his idea of the Jordan rules.
That's fantastic. Coach, Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. We want to do this again sometime.
No, I love what you guys are doing. And BJ, you know, the great thing about him is he's incredibly knowledgeable, incredibly passionate, knows the game inside out from every aspect. But he needs a steady hand like you.
When you start talking about his knowledge, you obviously haven't listened to our trivia section because...
No, I don't. I immediately leave there. I try to put I appreciate
all
it,
right.
Guys.
Keep in mind, if you are enjoying the podcast, make sure that you're getting it every week. And you can subscribe, especially if you're listening on iTunes. Subscribe to the show, rate, and leave a review. We love to hear from our listeners. And if you have some suggestions, some ideas in which we can improve the podcast, this is a new venture for us. We certainly want to be able to do that. You could also like and listen to the show on SoundCloud by, easy for me to say, soundcloud.com/BJandAndBuecher. Also, make sure that you're following us on Twitter at BJ and Buecher. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk at you again next week.